Linda Harwell had her knee replacement surgery yesterday. She came through the surgery well, and she's begun the recovery in a good fashion, so that's certainly good news. Kathy Perkins has a knee replacement surgery coming up here in December, and you...
Next Tuesday,
okay. You even wrote me today, and I didn't remember the date. Next Tuesday, so remember them, remember Hannah as she's recovering from her surgery, and Marcia Matthews, who's also going to have a procedure in December. That's what it was. Okay, beginning of December. Tonight, we're looking at Lesson 10 in our study of Job, and we're moving quickly toward the end of this study, so you need to begin thinking, if you haven't already, about what you want to study next in the auditorium class. Beginning with this next session, there'll be two sessions on Matthew, the Gospel of Matthew. In the second adult class, Mike Eisen and I will be repeating a class that we taught earlier this year or late last year, I forget, Roman Catholicism. And so if you haven't signed up for one of those classes, the young people will be studying 1 Corinthians, that is the class for the young adults. Philip Hood is going to be teaching that class. So think about what it is that you want to study for the next session, because it's coming up rather quickly. Okay. No, you're right. You're right. I misspoke. Gary and Ian are going to be teaching Judges and Ruth in this next class, and then I believe the Matthew class is after that. Okay. Well, it's a good thing somebody's keeping an eye on me. So we've been studying Job, and we're moving to the end. We've actually concluded the cycles of speeches between Job and his friends. Each of the three friends would speak in order, and Job would reply on the left side of your screen. Of course, that's not the beginning of all the dialogue. There's a discussion between God and Satan in the first two chapters, something that Job knows nothing about, and it really hurts him in terms of trying to understand what's happening to him. He's attributing everything, all of his suffering, to God, and that's puzzling to him because, like the friends, he believes that suffering is the result of personal sin. And Job looks at his own life, and even God testifies that there's no one like him. He's a blameless man, upright, one who turns from evil. So then Job laments in chapter 3, his friends have come from afar, and they've sat in silence with him. Then begins the dialogue with the friends, and we've spent a good bit of time on that. So we talked in the last class about Job's two monologues. Once the friends basically run out of soap and Zophar doesn't even speak a third time, then Job has some things to say. He affirms his innocence. We were looking in the last class at chapters 30 and 31. Well, 29, 30, and 31. 29, he talks about how things were before all of his suffering. And then in chapter 30, he talks about how things have changed. Everybody's looking down on him, staying aloof from him, etc. He doesn't have the respect, doesn't get the respect that he used to have. Then in chapter 31, he talks about his own innocence and attests by means of proposed curses upon himself if he's guilty of various sins. Now, when Job gets done, in chapter 32, we have the beginning of Elihu's speeches. And so let's take a moment or two to talk about those speeches. Well, I'll tell you, but before we do that, let's just say that what I want you to get out of this lesson, and we're probably going to spend a little bit of the next class period on this lesson, because we're looking at several chapters. So there's a lot of material to cover, and it would be difficult for us to cover it in this one class. So we'll probably finish this lesson in the next class. But I want each of us to be able to describe Elihu's explanation for human suffering. His explanation is going to be a little bit different than the friends, and we'll try to bring that out as we work our way through his speeches. So let's begin by talking about this first question. You know, it's interesting that Elihu is like a ghost up until this time. There's been no indication that there's anybody there except Job and his three friends, at least as far as the dialogue is concerned. And so Elihu has been there, as it's evident in chapter 32. He's been there the whole time. He's heard what the friends have to say. In fact, he's pretty upset with them, as he is with Job as well. And so he's been waiting to speak. And so the question one asked you, why has he been waiting? Well, he has been showing his respect for these other three men, including Job, I guess, because of their advanced age or their older age. If you look at verse 34 or 32 and verse 4, that's the comment actually of the author of the book. And then verses 6 and 7, Elihu himself speaks. Verse 4 says, now Elihu had waited to speak to Job because they were older than he. And then in verse 7, 6 and 7, he says, I'm young in years, and you, speaking to the friends, are aged. Therefore, I was timid and afraid to declare my opinion to you. I said, let days speak and many years teach wisdom. When Job talked about his previous condition before all of this suffering came upon him, what did Job say about his relationship with others? Do you recall? When Job walked into the room, or came into the gate, Robert?
He was very highly respected. The young people would disseminate, and the old men would stand and welcome.
And be silent. Listen for Job. Right, exactly. So they respected his age, and I think his character, as they understood it. If you look at Job chapter 29, verse 7, he says, when I went out to the gate of the city, of course, we explained in the last class, gate of the city was where was business was transacted, civil affairs took place there. When I went out to the gate of the city, when I prepared my seat in the square, the young men saw me and withdrew, and the aged rose and stood. So, indication of their respect for Job. The princes refrained from talking and laid their hand on their mouth. The voice of the nobles was hushed and their tongues stuck to the roof of their mouth. And so Elihu has basically acted the same way toward these four men, Job included, who are older than he is, and he's listening to their conversation, their dialogue. In fact, chapter 32 is really just kind of the background of Elihu and these four men as they've talked. Comments or questions about this? You know, our culture, our age, doesn't really respect age like in biblical times, age was respected. But Elihu says, I kept silent. I waited. Let those who have lots of days, let the years teach wisdom. But he will go on to say in 32, I listened for it and I didn't hear any of it. So he's going to be very critical, both of Job and the friends. And that's what we want to talk about here in question two. Why was Elihu angry with Job? Why was he angry with the friends? That's cheating, getting two questions in one. But if you read in chapter 32, right away, we know why this is the case. Look, if you will, at verse 2 there. Then Elihu, the son of Barachel, the Buzite of the family of Ram, which incidentally in our introduction to the book of Job, we indicated that the fact that Ram is mentioned here also helps us kind of push the story of Job to the right chronological period. We won't go into all of that right now. But anyway, it says in verse 2, he burned with anger. He burned with anger at Job because he justified himself rather than God. How did Job justify himself? Well, look at the thinking, the theodicy of the friends here with regard to suffering, human suffering. They believe that suffering, personal suffering, is the result of personal sin and in proportion to it, right? So here's Job. He's suffering. One of two things has to be true. Either he is guilty of sin and that suffering is legitimate, or God has gotten it wrong. God's being unjust in treating Job the way that he's treating him. So which one did Job choose? I must have done something to merit this, because God is just and he wouldn't make a mistake. Or did Job say, God's the one who's doing this to me and he shouldn't be doing it to me. This is unjust. Which did he choose? Yeah, 2B. That second one. He questions the justice, the holiness of God, the character of God, rather than assume that for some reason he's suffering because of some sin that he doesn't know about or is unaware of. Okay? So in chapter 9 and verse 21, I think this is a key passage along this line where Job is the speaker. He says, I am blameless. I regard not myself. I loathe my life. It is all one. I think what he means by that is that God doesn't make any distinction between the wicked and the righteous. It's all one. Therefore, I say, he destroys both the blameless and the wicked. When disaster brings sudden death, he mocks at the calamity of the innocent. The earth is given into the hand of the wicked. He, God, covers the faces of its judges. If it is not he, then who then is it? He asks. Now, we've been over this a number of times, but of course, Job doesn't understand what had taken place in chapters 1 and 2. He doesn't understand that there are other causes, or at least his convictions, his theology about suffering didn't include other sources of suffering. We haven't talked a great deal about that, but we understand pretty easily that sometimes we suffer because of the sins of others. Sometimes we suffer because of our own sins. Sometimes we suffer in ways that do not even involve sin. At least not directly. A tornado comes through a neighborhood and tears up houses and causes all kinds of damage in people's lives. Where's the sin involved there? No, it's just, it's nature. And you don't break the laws of nature. You get broken by the laws of nature. So there are different sources of suffering. But Job's not considering all of that, any of that. Job and his friends in the beginning, they're saying, if you're suffering, it's because you've done something wrong. And so Job has to choose between admitting or assuming that he has done something wrong. That follows the conviction that he has in the beginning and the friend's conviction as well. Or that God has made a mistake. And he keeps arguing that God's made a mistake. Chapter 9, verses 21 through 24 is hard to read. I don't care what version you read. Without coming to the conclusion that Job said some rash things. And Job will acknowledge that in the responses that he makes to the two speeches of God that we haven't gotten yet that conclude the book. Okay? So Elihu is angry with Job because he justifies himself rather than God. Okay? Then verse 3 says, he burned with anger also at Job's three friends because they had found no answer, although they had declared Job to be in the wrong. When it says there, they had found no answer, I believe that Elihu is talking about Job's questions. Because Job has looked around at common human experience, and he has said, well, wait a second. Sometimes the wicked seem to prosper. They don't seem to be suffering, even though it's obvious that they're wicked. A passage, for example, here in chapter 21, this says verses 4 through 34. I think it is actually 7 through 34. But Job just describes the wicked man. He says, listen, everything's going fine for him. His life just goes along smoothly, and he's blessed, and he's prospering. And then he just goes to the grave in peace, not a terrible suffering death. And the friends don't know how to answer that. Now, they have made a concession. Do you remember what their concession was? In response to Job's observation that the wicked don't always seem to suffer the way that their theology would demand. Do you remember? Yeah, Robert?
But not for a little bit,
The prosperity of the wicked is temporary. Oh, they're going to die. It's all going to come back on them eventually. But Elihu says they really haven't answered Job. And I've got a number of passages here that I'll suggest to you. Well, there's the slide that I was looking for, and apparently duplicated the wrong slide. So Job 13, verses 7 through 10. This is Job speaking. Will you speak falsely for God, he asks the friends, and speak deceitfully for him? Will you show partiality toward him? Well, that's exactly what the friends were doing, right? Showing partiality to God, assuming God's innocence, God's justice, I should say. Will you plead the case for God? Will it be well with you when he searches you out? Job thinks they're ignoring facts and then just proclaiming their belief in God's justice. Well, Elihu's kind of angry with Job for that very reason, that Job didn't do that. Job's affirming his own innocence and claiming that God is the one who's not doing the right thing. Here in verse 9 of chapter 32, middle of the slide, it is not the old who are wise nor the aged who understand what is right. Elihu says, I've been waiting for you guys to answer Job. You haven't answered him. He says there in chapter 32, verse 12, I gave you my attention. Behold, there was none among you who refuted Job. I think the New King James Version says convinced Job, or who answered his words. So Elihu is frustrated by the failure of the friends to really respond to some of the things that Job is saying. I've said this before, I want to say it again. I believe in the beginning of the book, Job thinks the same way as his friends. But he is being forced by this cognitive dissonance in his life. I'm suffering, but I haven't been guilty of sin. That doesn't work with the theology that I have believed and that the friends are pressing. Job is starting to realize there's a flaw in that syllogistic wisdom of the friend's view of human suffering. And so, 32, verse 15, 16, this is again Elihu. They are dismayed, they answer no more. He's speaking about the friends. They have not a word to say. And shall I wait because they do not speak? Because they stand there and answer no more? Should I just not say anything because they've run out of soap? Well, he has quite a bit to say. And so that's where we'll continue. Comments or questions about any of this? Yes, Ralph.
Just practical application. Oftentimes we don't see ourselves in our own faults, and we need to be ready to listen to someone else like Elihu when we are in the position of the three friends making an argument that doesn't make sense. We need to be ready to listen ourselves to outside counsel.
And if I could piggyback on your comment, I think your comment's well made, that we need to be willing to listen to others who may see things that we don't see. But I think the other thing, too, is when we begin to see some sort of contradiction in the way that we're looking at things, at least in terms of what the Scripture says, then there's got to be some sort of problem. And rather than just keep pounding the same thing that we have thought all of our lives, we need to step back and adjust our thinking so that it harmonizes with what the Scriptures actually say. Friends should have done that. The friends should have stepped back and said, well, you know what? You're right, Job. It doesn't seem like it's absolute that the wicked always suffer and the righteous always prosper. You have any idea why they didn't do that? Can you guess? Well, one of it's ego, right? Don't you think ego? If that's what I've always believed, then I must be right. If I have to step back and say, well, that's not accurate. Now I'm saying I was wrong. What is it? Fonzie couldn't say. They can't say they're wrong. Okay? So that's a possibility. And the other one is, if Job has destroyed their neat little syllogistic explanation of human suffering, then what is the explanation? Why is it that there's a just God, a righteous God, and there's righteous people who are suffering and wicked people who are prospering? That just seems wrong. So we're not even going to entertain that possibility. We'll just keep plugging away at our little theology about human suffering. Some of you have probably already read to the end of the book. And so you already know that God's not going to answer that question. He is not going to give Job nor the friends an answer as to why sometimes those things happen. God's purpose in asking all the questions that he'll ask in the last two speeches of the book is a very different purpose. We'll say more about that later as we get into that. All right, other comments or questions about this particular question? Yeah, Robert.
I feel like this is where authorship is trying to describe Elijah's author of Job, this book.
I'm sorry, say again, you're saying this is a place where it seems like Elihu is maybe the author of the book?
Yeah, verse 16.
Yeah.
I have waited because they did not speak. Now, you have an eye up here in the 14th where he is speaking, so I will not answer him with your words. So 15 to 16 looks like context of what's going on rather than actual work of what he's actually saying.
Okay, so you're saying 15 and 16 look like a comment by the author. Not necessarily what Elihu would be saying here. Okay, I'm a little confused because if the author is Elihu, then that would be Elihu saying verse 15 and 16. But you're saying it wasn't part of the conversation. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying it's not, okay. It's not a statement as he's actually doing contextual description of a circumstance where and then he explains it.
Okay. 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 Well, you know, I don't know. I'm going to stick with the idea that the author of Job may be unknown. Okay. But good comment to think about. Anybody else about this particular area? Yeah, Jeff.
I'm just wondering, when it comes to this idea of justification, do you think that Job had justified himself rather than God through the course of this whole discourse? Is that an accurate representation of what had happened? If you look back at chapter 32, and he 31 talks about God's righteous judgment and who he was relative to himself. And, I just wonder if that's kind of him summarizing his viewpoint of what Job has done rather than giving.
Oh, you're talking about Elihu.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
When he talks about that justification,
okay.
Justify himself rather than God, is that an accurate statement as far as what Job has done?
Yeah, and I said chapter 31, Job speaking in 31, 32, but in 32, or it may even be in 33 also, Elihu basically argues that God is righteous, God knows what's going on, he knows the spiritual condition of men.
It's 23, not 32, I messed that up. But, he has made statements that are very good about God's judgment.
Yes.
So, whether or not that was a fair, exact representation, I'm not so sure.
Well, 2 points. First of all, to talk to your last point, I think Job makes some contradictory statements. I think that's what happens when people are in despair, they're suffering, they're in an emotional extreme. At times, he has affirmed the righteousness of God, that God's going to find him. But then he also says, God's raced, run toward me, and he's hemmed me in, he's cast me in his net, he's put me in the wrong. So he's really kind of talking both ways. But I think that's normal for people that are really suffering. But to your other point, in the last class, when we were talking about Job's last two monologues, one of the points that we noted in chapter 31 is that Job almost appears to be perfect. That he keeps saying, and I did it, I didn't do this. If I did, then let my shoulder and my arm fall off. And, if I lusted after my neighbor's wife, then let somebody, have sexual relations with my wife. So he places curses on himself to try to affirm that he has not done any of these things. Somebody made a comment earlier, it's been a couple classes ago. It almost seems like Job is really engaged in hyperbole. He just hasn't done anything wrong, which comes to your point. And that is that it seems as though Job is justifying himself on the basis of his behavior and not necessarily being justified by God. I don't know that I'm prepared to pick out passages in Job to say that maybe there's more involved. But my impression in 31 is that Job really kind of goes overboard in proclaiming his innocence. But it's a response to what? It's a response to the friends. It's a response to Eliphaz, who in his last speech, Bildad, you know, has six verses. He basically says, how can a man be pure? But Eliphaz says, Job, you didn't help the fatherless. You took advantage of the widow. You know, he manufactures all kinds of sins. So I think Job feels the need to affirm his innocence. But I think he almost goes overboard to the extent that it's like, well, I'm innocent. I'm righteous because of all the things I've done, all the right ways I've lived. And so God then is kind of left off to the side, is my impression. I think that's what you were suggesting.
It's kind of similar to the New Testament idea of attempting to be justified by law and falling from grace.
Right. Right. Not to depreciate the need to do what's right, but when push comes to shove, nobody does that perfectly. And that's the point of Galatians 3:10 through 12. Yeah?
I think he's also comparing what he's going through, which is terrible suffering, to what he would have assumed would be a terrible sin, and he hasn't done that for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, if you believe you're suffering, the degree of your suffering indicates the degree of your wickedness. You know, Job says, listen, there's no way that it should be this way. Yeah, I think that's the case as well. All right, well, if you'll permit me, let's go on to the next question here. Question three, what figure did Elihu use to describe his eagerness to speak his peace? I'll let somebody else answer this. How does Elihu describe his eagerness to speak? I'm going to combine those two comments. New wine and about to blow up. He compares himself to wine that has no vent. This is in verse 19. Like new wineskins ready to burst. Verse 18, he says, I'm full of words. The spirit within me constrains me. Now, some of you now can relate to why some of my sermons tend to be a little longer. You're just full of words. Just got to say things. I'm just teasing. Elihu has sit and listened. I don't know if he's sitting. But he's listened to all of these friends back and forth and Job. And I want you to get the picture that as he sees that the friends are not really answering Job's objections to their theology. And Job is justifying himself. The frustration in Elihu is just growing. Have you ever been in a situation where there's a discussion going on and you know you should be quiet? You know you should just listen. Don't say anything. Let everybody talk. And then finally it's just like, I got to say this. There's something that just needs to be said here. That's Elihu. Elihu is just dying to get out and say what needs to be said. But because of his respect for the age of these others, he keeps quiet. But he says, eventually, I'm full of words. The spirit within me constrains me. Behold, my belly is like wine that has no vent, like new wineskins ready to burst. Come back to that. I must speak that I may find relief. I must open my lips and answer. He goes on to say, I wouldn't flatter. Do you remember a comment that Jesus made in the New Testament about wineskins? Where do you put new wine? You put it in new wineskins. New wine is wine, in some cases, that hasn't completely fermented as much as nature will allow. So what happens as it ferments? Well, it produces carbon dioxide, it produces gas, and that gas either has to escape or it'll burst the container that the wine's in. So Jesus says, it's in Matthew 8:17, I believe it is, 9:17, neither is new wine put in old wineskins, those that have aged and they become less flexible, more brittle. Wineskins were often, at least in biblical times, made out of animals, where they'd taken the meat of the animal. I don't want to get into this too graphic, but they would basically use the skin of the animal as a container. But over time, that skin would get brittle, or it would not, you know, flex as much. So you put new wine in there, and the gas expands, and it just busts the wineskin. So Jesus says, you don't put new wine into these old wineskins. If it is, the skins burst, and the wine is spilled, and the skins are destroyed. But new wine is put into fresh wineskins. He says, behold, my belly is like wine that has no vent, like new wineskins ready to burst. Do you pick up on that? It's the old wineskins that burst because they can't expand for the gas that's produced. Elihu says, I'm like this container, like a new wineskin, and I've got so much that I need to say and that needs to come out that I would burst even a new wineskin. He's engaging in what I would call hyperbole, okay? Exaggeration. But it's a vivid picture of someone who's just been, you ever find yourself just, you're tapping because you're just frustrated. You just want to say something, but you can't because you need to wait. And that's where Elihu has been. And so he says, I must speak that I may find relief. And in the language of his speeches, and there are essentially four of them. There are three speeches and what I've called a conclusion. It's really a fourth speech. And I've divided his continuous discourse, Job doesn't reply, into four speeches because occasionally in the text it'll say, and Elihu then continued. And that's typically a division in the text, as we've noted in other places. But as he continues his speech, listen, he's upset. he's not being a real gentle with either the friends or Job. All right, Elihu quoted Job four times in chapters 33 and 34. What point was Elihu trying to answer in each case? We're going to look through these four quotations. You may have found other quotations than the ones that I'm going to put up there. I tried to be careful about that. In chapter 32, he's basically going to talk about his need to talk and the fact that the friends haven't answered Job, that Job has not spoken properly. He does challenge Job's behavior in chapter 33, talks about how God warns men or chastens men in a couple of different ways. He mentions dreams or visions, and he also mentions sickness and pain. And Elihu gives expresses the view that these ways, although they may involve suffering, particularly the pain and the sickness, but God's intention is to pull somebody back from the pit, back from death. Stop him before it's everlastingly too late is the idea. But he's going to also quote Job. So the first quotation here in chapter 33, verses 8 through 11, he says, surely you have spoken in my ears, and I have heard the sound of your words. He's speaking to Job. You say, I am pure without transgression. I am clean, and there is no iniquity in me. Behold, he finds, who's the he? This is God. This is Job speaking, and he's saying, God finds occasion against me. He counts me as his enemy. He puts my feet in the stocks and watches all my paths. God's the one who's done this. He's treating me like an enemy. Okay? Look at verse 12. Behold, in this you are not right. I will answer you, for God is greater than man. Why do you contend against him, saying, he will answer none of man's words? That's another quotation. But Elihu is answering this complaint of Job that God is unjust. And I think the substantial part of his response is, God doesn't owe man a response, a reason. Do you remember the thing that Job keeps requesting as he responds to the friends? What is it that Job really wants? He wants to know why. How's he going to find out why? He wants to talk to God. He wants to reason with God. Back to Jeb's comment earlier, on some occasions Job says, I couldn't answer him. He wouldn't listen to me. He would put me in the wrong 1,000 times. And then other times he says, I know that if I get a chance to talk to him, that he will, when I'm tried, he will view me, I'll come out as gold. I'm misquoting here. But that he's going to justify me. So he's really saying both things at different times. But what he's wanted is to can I use this idiom? Call God on the carpet. I want God to come down and explain to me what's going on here. He needs to give me an answer. And Elihu says, no, he doesn't. He's God and you're man, and he's greater than man. I think he's responding to the attitude of Job with respect to his reasoning with God. Now, ironically, Job gets the chance to talk to God, doesn't he? And what's he got to say? Not much. That's right, not much. We'll see that in chapters 40 and 42. All right. So that's the first quotation. Here's another quotation in verse 13. He quotes Job's complaint that God would not respond to his words, his arguments. Elihu's answer is that God doesn't speak to man, does indeed speak to man. He speaks to man through other ways. We talked about dreams and visions and sickness. Verse 13, why do you contend against him, saying he will answer none of man's words? That's the ESV. The New King James Version says this: why do you contend with him? For he does not give an accounting of any of his words. Elihu says, God doesn't feel obligated to explain to you why he's doing what he's doing. Oh, and by the way, that's kind of God's message in the last two speeches, isn't it? Job, are you really able? Are you capable of understanding what I know and what I can do in the natural world, in the physical world? And you're questioning me about how things go in the spiritual world with regard to man's morals and his fate, his destiny in this world? Elihu says, he does not give an accounting of any of his words. I study Romans with one of the Zimbabwean preachers on Thursday mornings. We're going to study Romans 9 tomorrow. We begin in Romans 9:1. In Romans 9, what Paul says is God is the potter, you're the clay, and you don't have the right to say to God, why did you do this? Why did you do that? Because he's sovereign, and that's the message of chapter 9. God is sovereign. And he doesn't owe us an explanation for what he does. I think that's the point that Elihu is making here. So, third quotation. Look at chapter 34, verses 5 and 6. It's up on the screen as well. He was, for Job has said, I am in the right, and God has taken away my right. In spite of my right, I'm counted a liar. My wound is incurable, though I am without transgression. Maybe a little bit of an exaggeration, but I think he's saying, I haven't done anything to deserve the way that I'm suffering. And so Elihu is going to answer Job's complaint by challenging his profession of innocence. Look at verse 7. This is where the response of Elihu begins. Verse 7, what man is like Job, who drinks up scoffing like water, who travels in company with evildoers and walks with wicked men? For he has said, it profits a man nothing that he should take delight in God. Question. Is that accurate? I got one no, two no's, and a lot of people who don't want to say one way or the other. Has Job been walking in the company of wicked men, at least prior to his suffering? No. God says there's nobody else like him. God says to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? This is a righteous guy. Now, is it possible that Elihu is talking about Job's attitude, that now he seems to be kind of adopting the attitude of the wicked man? I see at least one yes. You think that's what Elihu's saying? I'm sorry? You mean Job has had enough? Okay. Well, he says some rash things, and he admits that in the end of the book. God says that. Who's speaking without knowledge, he says. Let him answer. Job has said, I'm without transgression, I'm in the right, God's taken away my right. And Elihu says that Job drinks up scoffing like water, walks with wicked men. Job has said, and here he quotes Job again, it profits a man nothing that he should take delight in God. Did Job say that? Do you remember?
Yeah, possibility of that, yes.
I'm sorry, I missed.
Oh, he put out that it was possible that there wasn't any benefit to being righteous.
Okay. Job has suggested the possibility that there's no benefit in being righteous. Jennifer, did you have your hand up?
Chapter 15 and chapter 9, 22, Job did say he destroys both the blameless and the wicked.
Yeah, that sounds a little bit... Now, Elihu is quoting Job, but I think really he's quoting the attitude of Job. But I think chapter 9, 21 through 24 suggests that it doesn't make any difference if you're wicked or righteous. It's all one. God punishes one and the other. It doesn't make any difference. If there's wickedness on the earth, it's because God has covered the faces of the judges. They can't see to do justice. If it's not him, who is it then? Job asks. So while Job may not have said these words specifically, he has, at least in his rashest moments, he has suggested that that's the case. Now, there was an occasion where Paul, I keep getting Paul in the book of Job. I got to stop reading the New Living Translation. Paragon of translational accuracy always. Job at one point describes the wicked man and how the wicked say God can't see, he doesn't know and all that. And he says the counsel of the wicked is not with me. And I think what Job is saying there is, I'm telling you what the wicked think, I'm not agreeing with them. I don't think Job ever agrees that the wicked are doing the right thing. Okay, that it doesn't matter whether you're wicked or righteous in terms of what you should do. But I think Elihu has a legitimate case here. He challenges Job's affirmation of innocence. He may go a little overboard here when he says he drinks up scoffing like water. That's kind of a little bit rough for someone who has been described as Job was by God. Okay, we're going to run out of time here. I think we need to get to the fourth quotation here. Look at chapter 34, verse 9. For he, Job, has said, it profits a man nothing that he should take delight in God. Right? Therefore, hear me, you men of understanding. Far be it from God that he should do wickedness, and from the Almighty that he should do wrong. For according to the work of a man he will repay him, and according to his ways he will make it befall him. Of a truth, God will not do wickedly, and the Almighty will not pervert justice. Who gave him charge over the earth, and who laid on him the whole world? If he should set his heart to it and gather to himself his spirit and his breath, all flesh would perish together and man would return to dust. I love that last verse. Every time you breathe, it's by God's permission. If he takes back his spirit, the spirit that he's given us as his creation, we all die quickly. Okay? But listen to what he says. God will not do wickedly. The Almighty will not pervert justice. That sounds kind of like the friends, right? Isn't that what the friends have been saying? Is there anything wrong in that? Saved by the bell. No, there's nothing wrong with it. That's true. The problem is that this world doesn't necessarily provide justice all the time. Justice is something that will certainly take place in the final judgment of God, but not everything that happens in this. This is not a perfect world where justice is always achieved. And that's part of the problem of the friends, right? They think it's always going to be seen here in this life, and that's not true. But the idea that God doesn't do wickedly, the idea that God doesn't do injustice, yeah, that's true. That's true. Part of the struggle, I'm going to say this and then I'll let you go. Part of the struggle of the friends in Job is that they don't know any other reason for suffering. But we do. And so we need to be careful about blaming God for things that we think are unjust. There's other reasons for why there's injustice in this world besides God did it to me or to us in general. All right. I said earlier as we began our class, this is question four. There are eight questions in the lesson. Guess what? We're going to spend a little more time in this lesson because I've divided lessons 11 and 12 into the two speeches of God. I don't think we need a full lesson for each speech. So we're going to spend a little more time in Elihu's speeches on Sunday. Thanks for the good comments and for your attention this evening.